back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. You know, we're getting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour and our Wise Conversations back out onto the road. We're going to be at Fadley's this week, and I am announcing a whole bunch of April dates, including with my dear friend Andy at G&A Coney Island Hot Dog, who's moved his business from Highland Town, where I was enjoying hot dogs as a child in the mid-1970s, up to White Marsh, where I enjoyed a delicious Spanish omelet on Sunday afternoon with some delicious wheat toast to get my weekend off to start. We'll be having a crab cake up there. Also at Greenmount Station in Hampstead, that's set up, as well as the Chaucer in Highlandtown. So the crab cake tour moving around. But for this week, down at Lexington Market at Fadley's, where, you know, east side and west side. This guy's a little west side for me, a little St. Joe, although he does not sing the fight song when he comes on, as Don Mueller does. Chris Pike has been my my first media friend from the News American back in 1984. Of course, long time with the Birmingham Barons, the Atlanta Falcons, the New Orleans Saints, and, of course, helping us out around here, as well as the Pro Football Writers Association, the Bahamas Bowl. And now back in Baltimore, where, you know, the one thing I get out of this whole Deshaun Watson story, Chris, and you can follow Chris at Blog and Tackle out on the social media places, is that it feels like this is going to lead the Browns into some awful dark space that's going to allow them to be a perennial 3-14 until it's 3-15 when they get the next game in, that the Browns will stink because of this. How are you? Welcome in. Nothing going on. Just guaranteed $230 million being thrown around, right?
Yeah, it's not a lot to joke about, unfortunately. I think that it was not the NFL's best week between the pursuit of Deshaun Watson. Obviously, you had four teams in the mix that were interested in having him as their quarterback. Knowing that he faces a significant suspension this year of some type, of some length, it's a question of how much it is. You know, we know that the grand jury said that there was no indictment of him on sexual assault, but he does have 22 civil suits against him for various things. And Jenny Varentis in Sports Illustrated wrote extensively about that. It is an ugly situation for a league that prides itself on its marketing and its outreach to women and female fans. And in a market like Cleveland, and I know that people in Baltimore, there's a longstanding rivalry with the Browns. But again, you could have a situation, you could put Deshaun Watson in any city in America, and you would have, I think, the type of reaction that we saw out of fans in Cleveland, out of businesses in Cleveland. Businesses are going to have to make decisions about whether they stay with the Browns, much like there are companies that have made decisions about the Washington football team in recent weeks. And no matter what you say in statements, and the Browns had several statements from ownership, head coach, general manager, you know, who did they talk to? How much did they vet Deshaun Watson and those allegations? What did they take into consideration? Because there are people who have been involved in that who said they were not talked to by the Browns in this. But again, you know, money trumps all.
And well, there were three other teams in line, right?
Right. And it's going to be a bad look when you give a guy a guaranteed contract, but you make sure that first year's deal, the first year's money that he gets, his actual playing salary, is minimal, so that any fine that he gets any suspension where he misses game checks is going to be of minimal, effect to him.
Talk about something that's not in the spirit of what you're trying to do, what the league is trying. It's not in the spirit of what they do, literally.
It is not in the spirit of what they do, and I will say this. His agent worked very hard to get him the best offer that he could get, and he had four teams who were very interested in him, and I'm sure that he was able to go back and forth and say, well, listen, we get this much guaranteed, because all the tea leaves pointed at a team in the NFC South. It pointed at the Saints, and it pointed at the Falcons, and those teams basically fell over themselves over their veteran quarterbacks that they have, especially in Atlanta with Matt Ryan, in order to get him on the roster. So they alienated the people that they already had in place at the position to try to get him. And the agent was playing them once Cleveland came back, was supposedly out of the running and said, oh, by the way, we're going to guarantee that whole $230 million. Sold. I'm going to Cleveland. Okay. When they say it's not about the money, it's always about the money. And that's the shame of it. And the Browns are going to have some repercussions out of this business-wise, fan-wise. There are going to be a lot of people going to be very uncomfortable with this. I actually do feel for the true fans of the Browns that are having an issue with this, but that's the way the NFL works. It's the same issues we had in Baltimore when the Ray Rice situation came up, and in other markets, Ray Caruth. I mean, you can go down the list
here. Well, Chris, by the way, Chris Pike is our guest, blog and tackle, my lifer pal. But more than that, let me upsell you a little bit into this, because much like Don Mueller, you and Kevin Byrne and people would be familiar, anybody in PR or front-facing management or corporate communication, which is what my degree was in, believe it or not, corporate communication from University of Baltimore, to be on that side of the fence. And crisis management is a buzzword in business and all around. And I think one of the things that sets apart what we do here, and we call them wise conversations, is try to bring on people who are truly expert. Yeah, you're my buddy from Southwest Baltimore, and you were the team manager at Loyola. But I mean, you've been in the center of having Michael Jordan on a bus, which is a crisis of its own, that isn't a crisis, but certainly in that sort of environment. You're in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina comes rolling in, and you're working out of trailers in San Antonio. And yeah, you were one of those guys. And then you were in Atlanta when Michael Vick was fighting dogs. And I don't know how that, you tell me when you came into work that day, what that looked like when you came in there after the word was out that, like, you've seen crisis management. And you know how difficult that is. You know that that's something, the Ray Rice thing, Bisciotti's still bee-stung from that. And it's one of the reasons he hasn't been around, period. The Ray Rice thing changed Steve Bisciotti as an owner in this marketplace, being front-facing. And probably the behavior of a lot of his compadres. He don't want questions about Colin Kaepernick and questions about Daniel Snyder in the market and all that. But to invite a crisis is a whole different thing than Ray Rice did what Ray Caruth is accused of, what Ray Lewis did. That's like, that happens in the framework of this. And then you take that on. And for them to take this on and then and pay guaranteed money, it really smacks of an owner who would at one point walk into Mike Pettine and walk into a draft day and say, Johnny Manziel is your new quarterback. You figure it out. But he can't play and he's a jerk and everybody knows it. Well, he's your quarterback. So, and your job depends on it. You'll be off coaching the Bills or the Packers defense if you don't get it done here. And this speaks to Stefanski taking the job there and them trying to sense Johnny Manziel, sort of sanitize the Browns as a place that's getting better. Like Angelos has always been trying to do that for 30 years, and then he doesn't put broadcasters on the road to call the games because they're too cheap to do that. It does come back to the owner, and you work for a couple of owners with mixed results, across all of it. But this smacks of an owner who's out of his mind, who has consistently been that guy, but at least for a little while, it's like Angelos. Everything was great with Angelos until he signed Chris Davis. And then you're like, oh, it's that guy again. Same dude that signed Albert Bell. Same dude that called down to the manager and told him, bench Chris Sabo. I want to see Leo Gomez. I mean, once they get involved, this is not the Cleveland, anybody in the organization, certainly not the assistants and secretaries and females in the building, who don't play football. This is an owner getting involved in this and guaranteeing money. This goes right to the top, does it not?
It does. And listen, owners want to win, and they're going to do what they want to do within the bounds of the rules to try to win. And we saw that. And there's a great story in The Athletic from my good friend Mike Sando about Urban Meyer and the fact that Jacksonville's ownership thought that Meyer was the answer to what they needed to do to get over the hump. And it was absolutely disastrous from start to finish in their building. And so when owners want to win and they get involved and Arthur Blank, and I wasn't there at the Vic dogfighting, I was already gone from them by that point. But, Arthur Blank got very, very close to Michael Vick, probably closer than he should have. And it probably clouded his judgment on some things down the line. They coddled him, and it cost him later on. Okay. Then he goes against a college coach and Bobby Petrino, and okay, disaster after disaster, because the owner sets foot in a room and he owns the team. He has the money. You have to listen to him. And a lot
and
of
you've
time
been around this where everybody kisses the owner's ass no matter what. That job number one is nod and speak nicely to Mr. Fill in the blank. Correct?
I think that, yeah, I think it is. And I think Kevin Burns spoke to this years ago at a symposium that we had for NFL PR directors, and it's called managing the building. You have to manage, good general managers and good coaches have to manage the expectations of the building, i.e. ownership, about what's possible and what you can do. And that's a big part of the job. You have to be honest with your ownership and say, we're lacking in these areas, or we're maybe a player away here. We might need to do loosen the purse strings on certain things, but there has to be honest conversations between management and ownership for it to work in a long term deal. But owners because they're successful businessmen. They're hard charging in a lot of cases. They're very results oriented, and that's where they made their money. So they're used to getting their way. And, you know, football people in the room will try to manage the owner and say, listen, we don't think this is a good idea because of X or because of reason Y. And the owner may just blow through that. And the coach and general manager basically have a choice.
Johnny Manziel would be the great example of this guy, this owner doing that. And then a few years later, in the middle of the night, rolls over on Baker Mayfield and, you know, gives this guy the guaranteed money. Part of this is the part I'm going to the owners meetings this week, Chris, right? I'm going down to Florida. I'll be in the room with all of them this week. The guaranteed money is the part that probably sets off Eric DaCosta saying, now, what does this mean for Lamar? What does this mean for Joe Burrow? We have now let the genie out of the bottle with the Players Association.
Right, and that's something the Players Association has been fighting for, and there have been there's only been two or three examples of a fully guaranteed contract. And it's something that the NFL has fought largely on the management side because they see the injuries and length of contracts, and they don't want to be in a position like baseball was with, let's say, Albert Pujols or other people signing 7 or 8 year deals for guaranteed money. And because of salary cap, that really, really hamstrings you. So,
In this case, he's buying a lot of insurance on this as well. So let's not forget that. That's the big story. Exactly. The Albert Bell thing is that Peter never paid that money. And that's why Albert Bell gimped around so that he could go roll into the insurance company and get the money. These guarantees will be an insurance issue that maybe a lot of NFL teams haven't had to worry about that. You know, it's a salary cap hit. It's a sunk cost. We're not worried about it. In this particular case, they're insuring this.
Right. And again, you've got a salary cap situation and you have something that has not been done. The NFL teams, like I said, to a team have fought guaranteed contracts. They're not going to give guaranteed contracts to the 53rd man on the roster, but you are going to have teams that are going to guarantee money to the top players at the top of the deck, which is quarterbacks. You may see that a little bit more. I don't think it's going to be widespread in the league because there's going to be a lot of pressure in the owner's room, and we certainly wouldn't want them to collude about that. But I'm sure that there will be private discussions about what that means for teams and salaries and upcoming negotiations. I mean, remember, you know, Flacco's deal when he signed it was a big deal in the league. That was big time money. He reset the market. But I remember you and I talking about that at the time, and I said, it's going to look like a bargain in 2 or 3 years once you see the next round of quarterback contracts.
Well, that's what Flacco sat and told me 3 weeks after he signed it up in Philadelphia when I was writing the book. He's like, you know, it just is what it is. You'll look back and laugh at this because, it you know, 5 years from now, it won't be a lot of money to whatever it is. The league generates a lot of money. Hey, I just made the Ravens a lot of money. I just won them a Super Bowl. I should get mine. And he should have gotten his, and he did.
Right. And
but
so
Sean Watson hadn't done anything except sexually assault 22 women, allegedly. You know, like, that's the part that's amazing to me. It's such an outlier that only someone desperate and incompetent would agree to this, because there's no Eric DaCosta would walk out of the building if Bisciotti did this. If Bisciotti rolled in and said, we're going to give Lamar $250 million over the next 6 years, guaranteed, no matter what. I'd say, did you see the last 6 weeks of the season? Did you see what happened to Ronnie Stanley? That's bad business. That's bad. We shouldn't do that. If it's Ray Lewis, we shouldn't do that. Guaranteed money in that particular case. If I own the team, or if the way the league works, it's outrageous. I mean, it's an incredible thing that this guy had that. They didn't give Patrick Mahomes this, right? Like, that this guy would have these allegations. It does speak to who they allow to own these teams and what the outcome is with an organization like the Browns. It's a perennial loser. Look at what they did to Baker Mayfield. Like, just that alone says, do I want to play there?
Well, I'll even take this, and again, I don't know if they'll address it or not, but well, let's take it over to Atlanta. Atlanta was a serious suitor for Deshaun Watson. They thought they had him. And this is an owner in Arthur Blank who had Michael Vick and had to live through that situation and live through the blowback that they got from that. They would be the team that I would think would be least likely to touch Deshaun Watson. If you know anything about Arthur Blank, he's not that type of owner. He learned from that. We think he learned from what happened with Vic, but now they entertain bringing him in. They've alienated a quarterback who has got them to a Super Bowl, who is a very good quarterback in the league, and they're going to have to mend that relationship. And they're going to have to explain why they thought that Deshaun Watson was the right quarterback for them. There's going to be questions that they're going to have to answer. They're going to be incredibly uncomfortable. There are going to be questions in New Orleans that has a female owner in Gail Benson about why they were interested in Watson and why they were in on it. And they're going to have to repair a relationship with Jameis Winston, who's going to be their quarterback going forward. So there's a lot of collateral damage here of their own making that those two clubs in particular are going to have to deal with. And let's put it this way. The Watson's agent did a great job in playing four teams against each other, and Carolina was in that mix too, that he got the best deal for his client. He did his job. He got his best deal for his client, and he got a team to give him an incredibly low base salary in year one, knowing that his client is probably going to be on the shelf for six games or longer in 2022. And the Browns decided that, even knowing that he didn't play in 21 and he's going to sit for significant time in 22, that they were willing to give him $230 million and guaranteed. And that's going to make general managers and owners in the room at those meetings this week. There's going to be a lot of side-eyeing going on at the Browns franchise for this, and the fact that the league has to deal with the fact that they market to women, and they're going to have there's a PR fallout from that. There's just a lot of things here. It's ugly. And I don't want to forget the fact that 22 women alleged sexual assault
were doing their job.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I've had hundreds of massages from at least dozens of massage therapists before settling on Suzanne, who became my massage therapist for most of my adulthood. But it's despicable to think it could happen once. It's beyond a trend at 22. And this to me was one awful organization, the Texans, doing business with another awful organization. And the Texans, the neighbor, the lawyer, the 22, like all the allegations, the racism, like all of that rolls out of all of this, it stenches up the Texans as well. To me, all along for this, that this was going on, under their noses. And there's really been, they've been the forgotten ones. I mean, I said all along, if I was going to hire Deshaun Watson, I said to Dennis Kalai, I said this to a couple of my business associates here who sponsor me. If I was going to, if you were going to hire this person who had these allegations, wouldn't you talk to the women? Like, I don't, not that is the be all, that they're even going to talk to you, but consider that if you're going to do this. I thought he was unemployable. I even thought in the modern era, if they made Kaepernick unemployable, this is unemployable from a quarterback standpoint. And boy, was I wrong, right? Like, 12% of the league is up, and more than that would have taken him on if they didn't have a quarterback because of the desperation of all of this, right? It really is it's a desperate play to have him, but then it's beyond my belief that Arthur Blank would have given him $230 million.
Right. And you alienate the people there. And oh, by the way, don't forget Robert Kraft had his own issue with a massage therapist. Okay. Correct. That the league had to deal with. And there was, you know, there was some fallout from that. I mean, it's so, you know, it's these owner meetings, I'm sure the closed door meetings with ownership and Roger Goodell, there's going to be some uncomfortable conversations among the group. And there's no way to sugarcoat this. You had 22 women accuse him. He is going to have court dates in civil court unless he settles. And if I was his agent, I would strongly suggest that at this point. And to settle the cases, because you don't want this hanging over him during his time in Cleveland as a quarterback. So your lawyers are going to tell you that. And listen, lawyers get involved in all facets of this. And you went back to the things that we talked about with Vic and other situations.
Well, when you're front facing as a PR representative, when you're Kevin Byrne and you're running the Browns and your owner comes in and says, meet your new quarterback, you better have a strategy and a press release or a tweet to send out. Right. And that, of course, will be crafted by the lawyers.
It is. And right. Because the lawyers are going to get involved. They're going to parse every word. Obviously, Watson's lawyers are going to be involved saying, we don't want you to say this. You can't say this. You know, so there are a lot of hoops that you have to jump through. And the other thing is, normally if you sign a quarterback like that, you throw a party for your season ticket holders and fans and everybody to come out and celebrate the fact that you signed this guy to this deal, that he's going to be the savior of your franchise. There's no such thing. There were Sunday statements put out from ownership, general manager, and head coach saying, we went through a very diligent process before we signed him. That's not a celebration of a signing. That's ducking and covering and hoping that the guy can get you home. But I'll tell you what, if the Browns are in a situation, let's say that Watson gets them to the promised land, okay, I guarantee you that the run-up to those big games, whether that's an AFC championship game or a Super Bowl for them sometime down the future, those questions are all going to come rebounding back to management, ownership, and Watson. They're not going to be able to stop the questions. They're not going to be able to stop, especially if these lawsuits continue on into his career. So this isn't something that goes away because he signed with them. It is something that's going to be on the minds of reporters and others, especially if the Browns do what they're paid Deshaun Watson $230 million to do.
For the football side of this and the Ravens and bringing it onto the field, because we do love that. Chris Pike is here from Blog and Tackle. And of course, my life for media pal, you can find him out on the Twitter thing, opining about lots of things, including March Madness over the weekend. The football side for the Ravens the last couple of weeks, this has been an interesting time in getting ready for the draft, and they've spent some money on some players they like. There's been a nice little haul and some you know, questionable things with Bradley Bozeman out and, now Patrick Ricard back in. So all of these things are happening in these moving parts. That with the backdrop of spring training, March Madness, for guys – silver-haired guys like you, and there's some silver in there if I let it go a couple days, that we're old enough that this almost feels normal, dude. Like to some degree, I went to see Dear Evan Hansen the other night. I went down to the Warner Theater and saw Snicks the other night. I'm going to the owners meetings this weekend. That there's a normalcy to all of this, and it's exciting. It's an exciting time for sports to be a sports fan.
It is. It's a, you know, March and April, between March Madness, the start of baseball, the Masters, you have a lot of events that are going on. The NFL is never out of season. We've learned that here between free agency and the draft. So there are a lot of things that compete for eyeballs and viewers and listeners and all mediums. And it's great for those leagues. And of course, oh, by the way, the NBA and NHL are coming down the stretch of their regular seasons. So there's a lot of competition for that dollar and your attention. And if you're a sports fan, regardless of what you root for or enjoy, there is something for you in that period of March 1st, April 30th, that you know, it can get you excited about being a sports fan again.
Chris Pike is here. We're hanging out. And anything you had on March Madness, you know, the Cinderella slipper and all of that stuff. And obviously, the weirdest backdrop of all of this, all my years as a Terp fan, and you're a Terp fan, right? Despite being a Loyola guy, right? You're a Turtle guy.
You know, I'm an observer. I'll say that.
Okay. You've been an observer. There hasn't been Terp head coach hiring speculation while my brackets are burning on day three of the tournament, right? Like, this has been a really weird thing, the Terps hiring a coach because they don't do it all that often. And then the outcry on social media of people who may or may not have been to College Park recently, but you know, there's a thicker fan base there of invested people who at least have an opinion about the coach being from Seton Hall. I'm not on either side of this. I think they hired a qualified guy. Now, whether this guy can win or not, or whether people thought they were going to, you know, dig up John Wooden and bring him back or hire Lefty Driesell, I don't know what you expect that they're going to get a top of class coach at this point. Most of those guys are kind of tied up a little bit. I'm wait and see, but I'm wait and see on Maryland as a Big Ten program, where they are, what Gary did that was 20 years ago now, that this is where they are, where they are, not where they think they are.
Right. I think there's always a disconnect at larger programs that have had success between what the alumni and the big donors think they should be as opposed to where they are. Okay. You know, I lived in the Southeast for over, you know, almost two decades. You know, I look at Auburn football here. They had some issues with their coach that they were trying to run out because they think they could do better than them. But it's, you know, Auburn's won national championships recently. So you have alumni, the two big alumni down there thought they could do better than the guy they had. And they were putting pressure on the board of trustees and other people. Maryland is, you know,
and the last guy screwing up government, but that's another story altogether.
Right. And so you have a situation in Maryland where you have an alumni base that thinks that, you know, that they should be at a much higher level. And it is hard to get those top coaches to leave their programs. Okay. If the reports are to be believed, Mike Bray at Notre Dame was in that mix. You know, there were a few other names. Rick Pitino was supposedly an interest by some, but it takes a lot of money to pry those guys away. But it also takes a lot of money, what they have to spend in infrastructure, which is coaching. You know, they obviously have a very good practice facility. They have some of the things they need to compete in the Big Ten, recruiting budgets, all those things there. And I'm sure that Kevin Willard will be a good coach at Maryland. It is a tough market. The DMV is highly recruited by coaches in the Northeast. Villanova has come in and plucked out players from Mount St. Joe. Cam Whitmore, one of my other things, the Baltimore Catholic League. You know, Cam Whitmore was our player of the year back-to-back seasons. He's going to Villanova next year. Jay Wright has come into this area and has plucked players out. And so Kevin Willard's job is going to be to take a look at what is in this area and keep those kids home. Can you do that? Okay. And that's what it's going to take to be successful, because there are very good players in this market. He obviously has success in recruiting at Seton Hall in the areas of the Northeast. He'll keep doing that there, but he's got to look at that area that's around him, rich in basketball talent, the DC area that had problems and, you know, and left these later years and, you know, and they had a little bit more success under Gary getting players to stay home. But that's what they need to do, because they do have great players here, and they can't have those players being plucked out to play at Villanova or Rutgers or other, you know, the Big East schools, UConn, whatever that is.
I remember the old days when it was just Georgetown and Wake Forest, right, and Florida State.
Right. Yep. And so now it's a whole different game. So, you know, it's going to be a task.
Put UMass in there too. They had Dinkle and Bright, but that was all Calipari thing.
Right. And so it's a much different recruiting game. And now, you know, and the other thing is too, is the one thing that has changed since Gary's time is the transfer portal. You can be very good very quickly. My old school, UAB down in Birmingham, and Andy Kennedy, who was a great player for us, who just came back as head coach, he wanted Ole Miss, which is hard to do. Okay. Ole Miss finally gets him out of there after he won a conference championship. He goes to Birmingham 2 years ago. He's got to play with what he's left with. He completely guts that roster, goes to the transfer portal and brings in five guys, five starters, basically out of the portal, and he gets them to the NCAA tournament. They ran into a buzzsaw, in the first round against Houston. But Andy is a very good coach, and it's proof that you can be successful quickly. And so what Kevin Willard's going to be able to do in that portal to find talented guys who can come in and help you win right away and sort of turn around what Maryland basketball's been the last couple of years under Turgeon and Danny Manning.
Well, he's probably thinking, I'm recruiting these kids, trying to keep them out of Maryland and get them here. If I had a Maryland badge on, maybe I'd get two of those kids every year. And if I can get those kids, I can go out to Iowa and win.
Right. And you know what you're facing. You know, you have to play Ohio State. You have to play Michigan. You have to play Michigan State. It's a hard league. Okay. It may not be ACC hard in the 80s and 90s, but it's still a gauntlet.
I said it's like whack-a-mole. I mean, Penn State's good one year. Ohio State's good one year. Purdue's good most years. Michigan State's good most years. We used to say Maryland's good most years. You know, they didn't like seeing Maryland on their schedule either. You need to make that part of it, because it's going to be the kind of conference where, you know, nobody's playing 85% ball in that conference ever. It's not Duke and Carolina and the rest of them the way we remember it, because of all of this, because the recruiting is that the difference between Seton Hall and St. Peter's and the difference between Coppin State and Maryland's not that great for a kid to say, I want to go play there because I like that coach. I like that school. I like the smallness. I can get to the NBA being a MEAC player or a Big South player, or I can get there doing it a different way. And I want playing. They all want playing time, right? So, you know, there's only five seats everywhere, even though they say there's 10 or 11.
Well, and also, too, it's now changed. The name, image, and likeness has changed this game considerably. The transfer portal has changed the game considerably. Coaches used to have basically all the power on whether you played or sat on the bench, how much playing time you got. All those things were in the coaches' sort of, you know, he had that power over the player for the 4 years they were there. Now the portal has given, and NIL has given, the players the power to make a choice as to where they want to play, what's best for them. And the coaches that are able to adapt to that the quickest and embrace it and help players get the NIL deals that help them want to stay a Maryland player for more than a season or two seasons unless they move on, or help them get to, you know, help them get to the NBA. I mean, you know, look at – we'll go back to football for a minute. You know, Nick Saban was not a great pro coach. In Miami, he was an okay pro coach, but what he took from the NFL back to the colleges was the support system. How do you get a player ready to go to the NFL? You know, when you go to Alabama system in football, you have a very good chance. If you're a decent player and you stay, you have a very good chance, A, of making money in the NIL, and more importantly, you're going to be playing on Sundays because they put a boatload of guys in the NFL because he has that system in place. And that's the kind of things that you have to do in basketball, too, to get these guys ready to play at the next level, whether it's at the NBA level, for some it's overseas, and getting them set up for the next part of their life. And so the coaches have to be a lot more open about that than maybe they were even when Gary was coaching. So it's a shift. And so it's
coaches want to win. Players want to get a good circumstance.
That's exactly
and win a chance to that's win, it. But a good
right.
circumstance.
They want to win, but they want a better circumstance than maybe what they came into because of a coaching change or other circumstances. And guys are looking, players are looking for their best deal and their best opportunity. So if you can sell that at Maryland,
you can make more money at Maryland than you can at Seton Hall being a basketball player.
That's exactly it.
We used to say that about Kentucky, and then they lost. Chris Pike is here. And, you know, that whole Saban thing, this is my side shot on the Bradley Bozeman thing, that even if you come to the Ravens from Alabama and they don't want you anymore, you can get $2.85 million out on the free market. The Bozeman thing was crazy, right? Like, it just says, when you see that, you know the Ravens weren't in on him. They just didn't want him anymore, period.
Well, right player, right price. We've heard that for, what, you know, three decades from the Ravens about that, and they've always encouraged players to go out and see what they can get. And if they can get more for their services and what the Ravens are willing to offer, the Ravens willingly say, hey, go ahead and take it. You know, it's a good deal for you. You know, we're not going to try to hold you to something that's not a great deal if you can do better. You know, I think what the Ravens did that with Ray Lewis and Ed Reed towards the tail end of their careers, go out and see what you can get on the open market. And some came back and some didn't. And Bozeman didn't come back because he got a great offer from another team.
Chris Pike, he's got a great offer from WNST in Baltimore Positive to hang out here and be a part of what we're doing. It's always good to see you, man. Good to visit with you and certainly talk about, you know, I think about guys like PR guys. I think of you and Moeller, I call you PR guys, the way they call me a radio guy or whatever. You know, when these sort of things happen for the league and I go down to the owners' meetings, you and I will put a little short list together of all the things I need to discover this weekend at the NFL owners meetings, but this should be a wild one. It's been a couple of years since I've been there, and I know you know what I'm talking about.
It's been a couple of years since they've been in person together, since before the pandemic, so I'm sure they've got a lot to discuss. There are a lot of things on the table, and I'm sure, like I said, getting 32 of these people in a room to discuss some of those issues, some of which we'll never hear about, some of which we might. You know, it's always interesting to see, you know, where the league is and the health of the league. But there are some serious questions that they're going to have to discuss this coming week.
Chris, you have a very unique writing style. And, you know, I knew that, sadly, early in the morning over the weekend when we lost John Clayton, that the tweets that came from the Pro Football Writers Association had your mark all over them. John was unique to me because he was such a celebrity when I met him. And I guess I've known John 2 decades. You know, I back to, I don't even know exactly when that happened, but when I met him, he knew who I was. He was so into the NFL, and I guess maybe he knew me through the Ravens or knew me from Baltimore or knew me because he was in radio or knew me because I was, you know, involved or, and he always called me nasty. Always. I loved hearing him say that, you know, I could hear his voice saying it. And he was just such a sweet guy. And, he took a shine to my wife and I at owners meetings. And of course his wife was battling, ALS and, in a chair by the time I got to meet Pat. And, you know, I went through the text that I have with him when we lost him, and he was always trying to get me to try new apps to broadcast with. I could read through the apps, but he's like, you got to get this new app. This app, it's going to change your life, Nasty. It's going to change your life. And you know how he was. So just anything on, because I think people would think it's strange that I knew him so well, but I did. And it shook me.
Well, John was a character, but he was a hell of a reporter. And I think everything that you read, and I encourage folks, one of his great friends who is a member of the PFWA board, Mike Sando out in Seattle, who succeeded John as the Seahawks beat writer. He and John were very, very close friends, and his remembrance of John, I think, is the best one I've seen yet as to, you know, the, what made John Clayton tick and why people loved him so much. And I think part of it was, is that what you saw on TV, what you heard on radio, what you read when he wrote in the newspaper, it was uniquely him. He was someone who kept a lot of information in spreadsheets. He wanted to learn as much as he could about the league and try to impart it to fans so that you understood sort of the business of the game almost as much as what went on the field. And he was a trusted, confidant to many among reporters. You know, you obviously were one of those people that he interacted with, but everybody has a John Clayton story. Everybody has a great remembrance of him. He was just good people. And, you know, what he did with his wife and taking
it
her
takes your words away. Yeah. If anybody witnessed it was unlike anything I've ever seen.
Yeah, she has MS, but he took her to every Super Bowl owners meetings and was a caregiver to her and was unable to do his job. You know, it hurts. I mean, that's, you know,
he's a special dude, John Clayton.
There are very few like him, and I hated the day that ESPN let him go because I never understood that decision among many that were made when they had the major layoffs. I think that hurt him, and I think that hurt the company. But, you know, John never stopped working. I mean, he was on the sidelines with the Seahawks radio network. He never stopped working. And never
he never stopped learning. He was learning apps and bringing them over to try to help me make my life better and my radio station better.
He wanted to learn as much as he could about the league and be able to just impart that information, because he never knew where that information might lead him on a story. If not that day, maybe in 6 months or a year or 2 years. You know, we've lost a lot of good people here. Therese Paylor, Don Banks, you know, Clayton. It's been a rough couple years for the Pro Football Writers. We've lost some really special individuals, and John was certainly at the top of that list. And I think a lot of people are smiling today, telling John Clayton stories about, you know, who he was and what he was. But he meant a lot to the league. When the commissioner of the NFL puts out a statement on a Saturday morning about a reporter, that I think tells you everything you need to know about what John Clayton meant to the National Football League.
Chris Pika, he is Blog and Tackle. And by the way, those two things that John always wanted me to try were Reported Enterprise and Lucy, L-U-C-I, Light. So I'm reading from John's text to me. So that's his gift to me. And watch, I'll try him and be like, I should have listened to Clayton back in 18. That'll be his party shot for me. Chris is out. I am in. We will be doing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery, as well as our friends at Goodwill Industries, putting that together at Fagley's this week, and a whole bunch of dates coming with the Chaucer, with our friends at G&A Coney Island Hot Dog of Highlandtown, now of White Marsh, as well as I'm even going to Timonium before it's all over, Green Mount Station in Hampstead as well next month. I am Nestor. We are WNST, Towson, Baltimore, AM 1570. And we never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.